Ooh, you want to play psycho killer? Can I be the helpless victim?
Cross your eyes and scream, man. Scream for your life!
Welcome. I'm your scream queen, Jenica Olin. This is my 8th episode. My objective for this podcast is to delve into the themes of horror, both real and imagined. Each episode will cover one movie in depth based on a theme of the month. Since we are officially in 2025, this year's theme is Be Careful What You Wish For. I mean, month. Did I say year? I meant month. I chose it because with a new year comes new hopes and aspirations. I hope to be more active this year and lose some of my excess pounds that I've have endured after my mid-30s. I really hope that happens. I can do it. I believe in myself. Sometimes what we wish for can turn out to be nothing like you imagined. The movies I'll be covering this theme from now until the end of January are Wishmaster, Reanimator, Hellraiser, Pan's Labyrinth, The Room, and Wish Upon. A quick layout of this podcast. Each episode will have an intro, brief synopsis, an analysis of the film, and then I get into the true crime of it all. I am a huge true crime fan, and I like to make connections between the true horrors that inspire our darkest imaginations. The truth is, the stuff on screen is way tamer than the true horrors that take place every day. In today's episode, I'm covering the first Hellraiser movie, made in 1987, which also happens to be the year I was born. That makes me feel special for some reason, because, you know, it was obviously a good year. This was directed and written by Clive Barker. There are rumors that his health is in decline, so I'm hoping that he's okay. He said that this is the last year he's doing conventions. He will no longer be doing conventions. He's going to be focusing entirely on writing. My husband and I admire all of his work, from art to his books to film. We consume all media related to Clive Barker. I cannot wait to see what he comes out with. The first Hellraiser film of the franchise stars Andrew Robinson, Claire Higgins, and Ashley Lawrence. Our actors that play the Cenobites are Doug Bradley as Pinhead. We have Grace Kirby as the female Cenobite, aka Deep Throat. We have Simon Bamford as Butterball. And we have Nicholas Vince as the Chatterer. Let's set the scene with a synopsis of the movie.
I have seen the future of horror. His name is Clive Barker.
Somewhere in North Africa, Frank Cotton purchases an antique puzzle box from the dealer who asks him, "What's your pleasure, sir?" Back at his house in England, Frank solves the puzzle box and hooked chains immediately fly out of the box and tear into his flesh. Demons called Cenobites from another realm appear to inspect Frank's remains. Their leader, Pinhead, searches among the shreds of flesh and blood and reassembles the pieces of Frank's face. He finds the mysterious box and twists it back into its original state. And the room appears empty, as if nothing ever happened. Frank's brother, Larry Cotton, soon moves into the same abandoned house, which he and Frank had grown up in, with his second wife, Julia Cotton, who previously had an affair with Frank. The house is a mess. Leftover food rots in the kitchen, and they both assume that Frank is off on one of his notorious adventures. Larry's teenage daughter, Christy Cotton, chooses not to live with her stepmother and moves into her own place. After cutting his hand on a nail and feeling weak from the sight of blood, Larry goes upstairs to the room where Julia is, the same room where Frank was killed. Larry's blood falls to the floor. As they leave the attic, Larry's blood is sucked through the floorboards where Frank's minimal remains have been hidden. Julia and Kirsty take Larry to the ER to have his hand stitched. Frank uses Larry's blood as nourishment to potentially regenerate his body. Newly reborn, Frank rises and emits a sustained shriek of pain. Later, Julia finds Frank alone in the room, his body only partially regenerated and grotesque. She's repulsed by his appearance, but Frank convinces Julia to help him restore himself to his full physical form, reminding her that while she was his secret lover, she promised to do anything for him. Julia succumbs to Frank and agrees to help him by seducing men and luring them into the empty attic where Frank hides. After Julia incapacitates them by hitting them in the head with a hammer, Frank is able to move in and drain them of their blood, which further restores his body. Frank tells Julia about the puzzle box, which he still has and uses to show Julia his experiences, and explains that by reclaiming his body, he has broken his deal with the Cenobites. He wants to fully regenerate himself and then run off with Julia before the Cenobites can track them down. Kirsty, already suspicious of Julia, eventually sees Julia bringing a strange man home and sneaks into the house to investigate. In the attic, Julia beats the man, allowing Frank to feast on his body. Kirsty approaches the attic, unaware of what's happening within. Suddenly, the bloody man stumbles out of the attic, soon followed by a skinless Frank who confronts Kirsty. Before Frank can grab her, Kirsty picks up the puzzle box as a weapon. When she realizes it holds value to Frank, she throws it out the window and escapes from the house, picking up the box as she runs down the street. Disoriented, Kirsty awakens in a hospital where she tells herself it was all a terrible dream, until a doctor hands her the puzzle box. Kirsty begins to play with the puzzle box and inadvertently solves it. The walls of her hospital room open a dimensional door with a long tunnel behind it. A large, hideous monster starts to chase her, but she escapes. When she looks back at the wall, it's sealed up, though she can hear the beast roaring behind it. Suddenly, the walls of the room begin to change again, and the Cenobites appear. Their leader, Pinhead, tells Kirsty that she summoned them. Therefore, they must take her to their world of pleasure, pain, and suffering. She then begs them to spare her, offering to lead them to Frank in exchange for her freedom.
Thank you. box. You opened it. We came.
It's just a puzzle box!
Oh no. It is a means to summon us.
Who are you?
Explorers in the further regions of experience. Demons to some. Angels to others.
It was a mistake! I didn't mean to help anyone! It was a mistake!
We can't. Not alone.
You solved the box. We came. Now you must come with us. Taste our pleasures.
Kirsty escapes the hospital and races to her father's home to warn him about Frank. Larry informs Kirsty that Frank had been taken care of, though his behavior is strange, and she doesn't notice that Frank has blood along his hairline. Kirsty finds a bloody corpse that's been skinned in the attic. The Cenobites appear, demanding the man responsible for this death. Kirsty believes they want her father, and she runs to warn him. However, she soon realizes that Frank has murdered her father and stolen his skin and worn it like a suit to fool Kirsty into believing that he was her father. Frank comes after Kirsty, accidentally stabbing Julia in the process. Frank then drains Julia of her blood, further nourishing himself. He then goes to the attic where Kirsty is hiding. Kirsty weeps and accuses Frank of murdering her father. Frank reveals to Kirsty that her father was already dead inside anyway. Having heard Frank's confession, the Cenobites appear. Frank tries to kill Kirsty for setting him up, but dozens of hooked chains grab him, holding him back. His last words are, "Jesus wept," before the chains rip him apart. Kirsty runs through the house, eager to escape, but the Cenobites want to take her as well. Kirsty finds the puzzle box clutched in the hands of Julia's chained corpse on a mattress. Kirsty's boyfriend, Steve, arrives just as Kirsty reverses the box to banish the Cenobites. Right before the two can leave, the box changes itself again, and the monster she escaped in the hospital appears. Kirsty is still able to banish the monster, and she escapes with Steve. Afterward, Kirsty tries to burn the box in a fire outdoors, but the strange vagrant appears and picks it out of the flames. As the man is consumed by the flames, he transforms into a winged skeletal demon that flies away into the night. In the final scene, the box is shown in the hands of the merchant who originally sold it to Frank, asking another prospective customer, "What's your pleasure, sir?" Now it's time to talk horror, and my guest today is Peter Olin. He's my husband, the owner of Conduit, and he is a concert promoter for Indoxa Booking. So, how are you doing today?
Good. Happy to be here in the Scream Queen studio.
Yes, our otherwise known as our dining room.
Yeah.
Professional. So I just want to remind you really quick that there is a lot of BDSM type stuff in here. There is a lot of talking about pleasure and pain. our daughter could one day listen to this episode, so make sure that you're not being too graphic.
You make sure you're not being
too graphic. Well, I've already given myself that disclaimer, so I'm not giving you that disclaimer. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So as I say that, you know, in the beginning, the movie is bookended with a specific phrase, and that phrase is, "What's your pleasure?" So what is your pleasure when it comes to this movie? What did you like about it the most? Or maybe what was the most painful part for you to watch?
Well, no, I don't think, I mean, I love Clive Barker, so this is kind of where it all started for things I'm interested in. But the movie hits all the different things I loved about horror prior to the current century, right? I mean, it's got this darkness and grittiness to it, both like in the story and the filmmaking and the color choices and all this different stuff. It's got a really great theatrical score, even though there was like alternate scores they were talking about doing. But it's got gore, but it's not just about gore. There's a whole story going on. There's like these practical effects that I think enrich it. Like you can even go to the beginning of the movie where they've ripped Frank's pace apart and the Cenobites are like piecing it back together. It's obviously like rubber modeling, but it's just kind of a cool look compared to, you know, a CGI, something like that recently.
Yeah, no, the practical effects in this movie are, I think, what make it. And doing my research, I found out that there was a lot of lube used and condoms used for the practical effects.
They're always slick. If you look at the Cenobites in a lot of it, they're always wet. I don't know what's going on with that, but they're wet.
It's a lube.
They're very
That's
wet.
That's what that is. And then Frank, you know, and very, like, he always looks really saturated. Moist. Yeah, he's always very shiny.
But he doesn't have skin for the... But that's part of the grittiness, though. That's the good look, is that I think it's something horror movies now miss, is that when they have gore, it's either over the top or it's just oddly implied, and Hellraiser seems to do both to great shock value.
No, I think the most shocking scene, they did such a good job when it came to Frank being like reanimated.
Yeah.
And that was actually filmed. They did like a backwards filming of that. That's how they were able to recreate that.
Yeah, some of that, I mean, I'm not as up on the practical effects, but some of it reminds me of like the way people do like claymation and all this different kind of stuff, right? I mean, it's just like real hands-on. Watching all the effects work that go into this just to make like a 10-second scene is pretty impressive. But it just has a I always do a poor job articulating this, but it just has a better feel. I don't know. I don't know what it is. It just seems a little more visceral.
Did you know that Clive Barker did not name the character Pinhead? He was not named Pinhead. And yeah, he doesn't like the name Pinhead.
Yeah, in the book they don't really have names, I think. Right? It's just kind of one character.
He's known as like the priest. Mm-hmm. And there are, like, the other Cenobites do have names later on, but they're not really, no, they're just, like, one, they're kind of seen as, like, one entity coming from this, you know.
Well, so much, I mean.
Different dimension.
Well, they make so, in Hellraiser 4, they make so many of them. Mm-hmm. In that whole history of the box, you see all these different people get made into Cenobites, basically.
Yeah.
I don't think you get that. In the first one, you don't get as much background like that. I mean, they're there. They're distinct. There's obviously like the female Cenobite and all this other stuff, but it's not as, you don't get as much explicit, what's the word here, personality or history to it.
One thing about Clive Barker that I like is that he is so, almost in the way that Star Trek is like very accepting of all others and all different types of people. And he explores different themes of like what is pushing the limits on some things. But even so, like when it comes to like female sexuality, he wasn't afraid to put an older woman on screen and as still like sexual beings. Like they didn't really do that in the movies at that time.
Yeah, I think it was kind of known that it was revolutionary and something that was inspired by his own personal relationships at the time. So he was, I'd read this a bunch where he was involved with an older woman and that was kind of a nod to that. But yeah, it was supposed to be to some degree an edge of feminism to it because of the older woman being portrayed as a sexual being and not just kind of older, things like that. Which I think now is kind of funny to think about because there'd be really nothing out of the norm. But at the time, as you're saying, I suppose it was. But Barker talks about this stuff a lot where he thinks that the point of fiction is to push boundaries. So what you're saying, I mean, it's dead on, but it's supposed to be the creation of this. I think his eye-rolling moment is always in fiction that just seems so standard. So there's a lot in common with people like Harlan Ellison, like an earlier generation, things like that, who also wrote Star Trek, one really famous episode. Mm-hmm. And then Hellraiser had Andrew from Star Trek Deep Space Nine. So all roads lead back to Star Trek, I think.
We're very Star Trek, very Trekkie minded. To speak on Clive Barker and women, I think from everything I was seeing, I think he had a good relationship with his mother.
I don't know anything about that.
In my research that like whenever this movie first came out, he showed it to his mom and she started crying like tears of joy when she saw the opening credits in his name. And then I guess he like leaned over and whispered that that would be the happiest she would be for the next 2 hours.
Yeah.
Watching
Can't
his
see
movie.
Mom being into that movie.
Well, I mean, she watched it with him, so she must have been supportive. It sounds like he had a relationship with his mother, at least. I don't know. Talking about, like, the Cenobites, the other Cenobites were supposed to have more dialogue. The Chatter guy, he was supposed to have lines, and Butterball was supposed to have lines, but they ended up giving those lines to the female Cenobite, who was known on set as, like, Deep Throat, but they had to, like, because that has a lot of really negative connotations, they couldn't like name her that really. Because of the practicals, because of how their makeup was and things, like they couldn't talk. It was interesting reading about the Cenobites and their makeup and how it affected their acting.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, it all seems pretty intense, and a lot of it's, you know, stuff over skin, really tight clothing, all this kind of stuff. So, yeah. I got to think it's not going to be an easy time. And Pinhead's the one, Doug Bradley, I guess, is the one who's the least constrained. Mm-hmm. Although I'm sure the whatever fit over his head with the pins was not the most comfortable thing in the world. But his actual talking or anything is probably one of the only unconstrained. Although it's interesting because the female Cenobite's not, she's also not very constrained. The Chatterbox, obviously, and all that are different, but yeah.
Yeah, no, she had to take over some of the other guys' lines, and there wasn't supposed to be, like, a main Cenobite. After, like, the makeup and after the practicals and everyone, like, he was a standout among them. And then they kind of realized, like, he was going to be front and center. Even though he only has, like, 8 lines in the entire movie, he's the poster.
Well, everything in the story revolves around him, Frank and his brother and everything. I mean, so much of it really is, that's the appearance, right? That's the mascot of the whole series.
So Larry gets cut on the bed and then his blood is like dripping. One thing that really got me about this movie is all the intense sounds. It's almost like you're an insect and your senses are so heightened and you're hearing every little drop of blood. You hear every maggot squirm. It's very intense to your senses. And I think, I mean, that's on purpose, right? Just like the pleasure and the pain and like it's just like everything is heightened.
Yeah, it just points, to better movie making too. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, it's the whole thing is Barker making it immersive. And it's a huge aspect of the body horror thing too, mm-hmm. right? Always an aspect of Hellraiser, Barker's work. Like it's always in there, and you know, the sound being just as visceral as the gore and all this, I think makes it immersive, if you will, but kind of hammers the point home.
Yeah. What are some other sounds? I like have a whole thing on the sounds because
the chains, right? The chains swinging.
Yeah, the chains swinging.
There are maggots writhing in the beginning, right? Yeah. When he goes in and looks at the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's the maggots and the roaches crawling, which like it just like makes my skin crawl. It's like.
Well, but the whole house has sounds, right? So it's the creaking because it's the old house. They're trying to emphasize how unhappy his wife is about being there for a variety of reasons. Yeah, there's a lot.
Even when the flesh is being reanimated, I think one of the parts that makes that scene so
intense is you can like hear the slow, you can hear the ligaments like being assembled back together and like bones cracking back into place.
It's the best.
It is the best. Even like loud laughing, train stations, the most mundane sounds are heightened to like such a high pitch in the movies that it...
I don't know. It'd be something interesting to look into. I don't really know Barker's approach to that stuff. I know he's really hands-on with everything in Hellraiser. I don't know how much the sound design is like tied into the kind of story, you know?
I mean, it definitely plays into the characters, and because words aren't always necessary. Like, the chattering teeth of the chatterer is creepy as fuck.
Yeah. Although a little on the nose.
A little bit. Oh, my God. All the fingers, too. All the fingers and the mouths. So gross when the chatterer puts his fingers in Christie's mouth.
It's good. It's good. I guess it's a real bonding moment.
I don't think...
I think it's back to body necessary. Horror stuff. It's not, you know, Tarantino's got his feet and Barker's got his... fingers and ass. I don't know.
Yeah. No, it definitely seems like a fetish.
Well, the whole thing, right? Is
yeah. I mean, the whole thing is about fetish and BDSM and all that kind of stuff. So...
As Barker said, it was inspired by clubs. One specific club he was going to in New York at the time.
Yeah. I saw that, like, a club and then also in, like, Amsterdam. And then he was inspired by, like, punk. So some of the tropes that are in this is like a family affair. So, you know, we've got the deception of Frank being Larry's brother and he's having an affair with Julia. I'm not sure what I think about Julia and Larry as a couple. Like, she seems to hate him in the entire movie.
Yeah, she does. What do you mean you're not sure? That's the whole premise, is that she doesn't want this button-down, boring life. There's nothing to think about.
Well, I think, so she has an affair with Frank, but, like, she doesn't leave Larry. She doesn't want Larry to get hurt, because when Frank...
He causes him to get killed.
Yeah, but...
She's a bad eventually, person. No, it's not.
She tries. She's a really good villain, but she... So... Julia does try to stop Frank from killing Larry in some moments.
I think you're being bizarrely sympathetic here, or empathetic. I don't know what's going on. There's no upside to her. Like, you can talk about the feminist edge of the older woman's sexuality issue, but she's not a good person. There's no like, oh, but she really loved her husband. It's definitely not what was going on there.
I'm not saying that she loved her husband. I think she just, like, she wasn't ready.
She resented him. It's not the very beginning of the movie, she resents him.
Yeah.
And he even talks about, we could be happy here, and he's going through this thing, and she just, like, eye rolls him.
Yeah.
And the human, no, she's a horrible person.
Okay, so I do want to talk about Frank really quick, because... If you compare Larry and Frank, like, who would you rather have, Larry or Frank?
Yeah, but that's silly. Why would you want the person who just used her in the first place?
Well, right?
No, there's no, you're, this is weird. You're weird. You're off on this one. I don't know. There's no...
I, like, there's nothing hot about Larry. There's nothing attractive about Larry. He's like this safe, cool, nice dad. Like,
what an asshole.
He's just like, he could be anyone's dad.
This sounds like the kind of reasoning where you...
boring.
No, this sounds like the kind of reasoning where you like go after the other guy. You go, I didn't realize he was so mean. I'm like, that's his whole character. The fuck are you talking about? He's always been.
But you can.
He's completely selfish. You can't.
But you can change him.
You're out of your mind.
I'm just joking. You can't really change him. I mean, did I change you?
Yeah, not in your wildest dreams.
Like, that whole affair was essential for the storyline, especially for her to be able to help him. Like, the fact that, I mean, she must have really had. Been infatuated with him. Like, I don't know if she loved him, but she was so infatuated with him that she was willing to kill for him. And then, like, he was a really gross, like, gooey stump. And it didn't, like, she looked at him and she still was like, yeah, I'd kill for you. You gooey stump. It's pretty gross.
Yeah, I don't, this isn't a good thing. I don't know.
No, it's not a good thing. I'm just saying this is really gross. Like, it's, like, she kept having these, the flashbacks, and I think those set as, like, a motive, you know, to explain her motivation on helping him, because if they didn't do those flashbacks and you were just looking at this gross, gooey thing on the floor and then her, you'd be like, what the, why are you helping him? Like, it would make no sense.
Yeah, but that has to do with her sexuality, though, too. It doesn't even have as much to do with him, right? So when they first go up there and found where he was in the second story of the house, she's looking at all these sexualized pictures of him, and I'm guessing a prostitute or something.
Mm-hmm.
In the thing. I don't know. I don't know where your sympathy for this guy's coming from. This is a weird move.
I'm not saying that I sympathize with him. I'm saying I don't sympathize with him. I'm saying that if we want to just talk about attractiveness, Frank is definitely the hot brother.
We don't. Why do we
brother.
Want to talk about attractiveness? Who wants to talk
it
about
it? It makes
that?
It because we're talking about pleasures. So
no,
that's
we're not.
Why.
We haven't.
Well, it's in there. So we are. This is what we're talking about. The pleasures. And if I have to think about the pleasures, I would rather think about the pleasures with Frank than the pleasures with Larry.
Gross.
So I kind of just have like a list of things that I noticed that were, I don't know, they just things that stuck out to me. I don't know if they mean anything or not. So here we go. I'm going to list something and you tell me what comes to your mind. They make love on her wedding dress.
What comes to mind?
Yeah.
Nothing. I don't know. It's a point of her betrayal to her husband.
When he says, you gonna let me kiss the bride? And then he like cuts the strap off her nightgown. It's just like very intense, like rapey scene.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So let's move on. When she finally kills Larry, I don't think she needed much of a reason to kill her husband. Like, she really hated him, which we already kind of
talked
about.
See, this is the opposite of what you were just saying. You're like, well,
I'm not saying. I'm saying that she didn't want. I think she didn't want to give up, like, a certain kind of lifestyle. And she knew whether she loved Frank or not, he wasn't going to provide for her.
Yeah, so the beginning of the movie points out that his daughter is making an unnecessary show of needing to get a job because they have more than enough money. So yeah, so your description of the character is she doesn't have to work, they're financially independent, and she just wants to cheat on her husband. Cool.
She wants to keep him alive so she can keep her lifestyle. That's why she's trying to keep him alive.
It's pretty despicable.
It's not good. I'm not saying it's good. It is what it is. Oh, okay. So all those bar scenes where first guy was a complete asshole. When Julia brings home the first guy, he says to her, "You're not going to change your fucking mind, are you?" Very like predatory way. And it's just like, I did not feel bad for him being murdered. He was really creepy. All right, fine. Okay. So you... And I did feel bad for the last guy that they killed, though, because he was like, I don't do this kind of stuff. And he just seemed like he was really out of his element. And he was like a big dork. And then they killed him. And it was very sad. That was a sad kill. You have no empathy, do you?
No. I think they're trying to make her flesh her out a bit more. And I don't think it works.
I really like the quote that Frank says. He says, "Every drop of blood you spill puts more flesh on my bones." That's a good line.
It kind of oscillates between being funny and cheesy and serious.
Oh, and then every time he, like, takes the life force out of these people, they look mummified. Like, that first guy that he kills, he looks so fragile, he looked like a mummy. Like, she just, like, picks him up. So Julia's able to just, like, pick him up and, like, take him to the other room.
Isn't that the point? Like, sucking the life force out of him.
Yes. Yes. It is. But I was even shocked at how much he was sucked dry. I felt really bad for Christy. Christy was an amazing final girl. She was great. I really loved her in this movie. I really love the way she handles herself at her job whenever she's working at the pet shop. And she tells, like, there's the customer that's like, I want to speak to a manager. And she's like, well, the manager's not here. And she's like, well, I want to speak to a manager. And she's like, well, you're going to have to wait. Like, she just did not give any fucks. Like, she was not there to appease these people. And then she walks over to, like, the seemingly homeless man who was, like, very weirdly stalking and watching her the night before. And he puts his fist in, like, the crickets, and he pulls his hand out, and she's like, what are you doing? And he starts, like, eating the bugs in front of her, and I love her reaction because she's just like, get out of here. She's, like, telling him to get out. She's still, like, standing up to this, like, guy eating crickets. Like, that's scary.
Yeah, she plays the heroine.
Yeah.
The movie.
But we can be impressed with that. Okay, we can be impressed with the heroine of the movie.
I mean, she main characters it through at least two, right?
Let's talk about Christy, okay? Because I want to just talk about some of her moments. So she's also, like, whenever she goes into the attic and she sees that her stepmom has this, like, creature thing that she's, like, luring men into the house for, she realizes, like, Frank's about to attack her, and then she realizes that the box means something to him. So instead of, like, handing it over, or she just, like, very quickly acts, and she throws the box through the window, and she's like, you want it? Fucking have it. And then she, like, screams running out of the house. Like, such a good moment. She saved herself. She was very good. Okay, fine. Not impressed. Okay.
I don't think every character is, like, she barely makes it out of this alive. Every character is not, like, a hero.
She is a hero, though. She's really great, and she's, like, very quick-witted. She has a sense of, like situational awareness that only a final girl would have.
She is a final girl. There's not a lot in the movie.
Oh, God. I need to talk to more women on this show. Another amazing Christy moment is at the end of the movie, when she's, like, fighting the monster to get the box and put the box back together. Like, she is not giving up. She is such a badass.
See, I never thought of her as a badass character. I always thought of her as, like, weak, but basically barely gets through.
Very different perspectives. You are wrong and I'm right. Let's just say that.
That makes a great conversation. Well, what's the moral supposed just to be? Characters the brave? If you're ever in a situation with Pratap's demons, be brave like this. Come on. Be brave like this person.
You can learn lessons from Christy, okay? There's no lesson here. She's got things to teach people. The only lesson in the about movie. Fighting back.
She doesn't even fight. She grovels. And if Pinhead would have taken her the first time she gets caught, that'd be the end of it. She didn't do anything clever. She traded someone else in.
That was clever, though. She's like, oh, shit, how did this even happen? She was very quick-witted whenever she decided to turn in her uncle and ask about, like, Frank and all these things. I don't think so. I think she did an amazing job. But I just want to talk about Joseph Mengele because it was mentioned in there, and I did find it, like, an interesting connection that was a line that Larry said. Because Joseph Mengele, you know, he just says, doing something like Joseph Mengele. I can't remember the exact line. He just makes a comment doing something. He's like as gentle as Joseph Mengele or something. It's like, it's a very short line. There's not much to it, but you know, there is this, you know, Nazi doctor that he mentions, and it's pretty. It's like
reading a lot into it, right? I mean, isn't this just Clive Barker writing, being like, oh, this? I don't know if it's like a significant character point. Like, it's a weird reference. You could even go the other direction and say it's a weakness in the writing, right? It's a kind of weird character reference that maybe he wouldn't use if he's such a good guy.
Well,
but again, there's always menace and threat under what he's doing.
Yeah, I don't think he's a good guy throughout. I think that you definitely see the cracks in the wall whenever he gets upset with...
it's not a happy marriage. There's a lot of tension there.
Yeah.
Mainly her fault. Basically her fault. Pretty much all her fault.
Okay. I don't know. Are there any tropes that you can think of that this movie maybe started?
Started?
Yeah.
I can't think of anything it started. I mean, it's a pretty self-contained series, right? I mean, I think part of one of the reasons that you like it or you've talked about it, one of the things you've emphasized a lot is that it's different from everything else that's happening. So I think it avoids some of the early tropes. But no, I mean, I think it stands alone, right? Hellraiser is one of these things that it's, the, you know, it gets tried out and it gets a little repetitive on themes as you go throughout the series. Mm-hmm. But it is, you know, for the time, if we're really just thinking about the first movie, as you said, it points to a lot of things that are different. It doesn't, you know, necessarily repeat some of the same tropes from the time period, but it does, you know, there are these cheesy lines, like you said, and all this, but there are a lot of themes that are different than a lot of horror at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I do like that. It's not like just this mindless killer. He is supposed to be like a very smart intellectual like entity.
Although he does get tricked a bunch of different times throughout the series, so.
We're not going to mention that. He's very smart, okay? Just certain final girls are smarter than Cenobites. Women.
Hellraiser 4, he gets trapped in a spaceship version of the bot.
That's so fucking dumb. Yeah. Well, we're not going to talk about that because Clive Barker was not part of that. Okay? He wasn't. He was not part of that. Thank you for being on my podcast. Thank you for being a guest. You know, even though you can't get away from me, I appreciate you being here and really talking to me.
It wasn't really a choice, but it did happen. It is a thing that we did.
We did it. Thank you.
I love Clive Barker, so I'm always happy to talk about
it. No, I know you do. We both love Clive Barker, and that's something we've bonded over, I think.
I think that Clive Barker is something that I've been a fan for a long time and you've seen previously, and we've explored a lot of his works together. It's been really interesting, all the different horror movies we've been watching before this and then because of the podcast you started has really given us a way to look at how different some of these are. So like Wishmaster was one that I hadn't really paid attention to a lot, but then you kind of brought up these connections to the Hellraiser universe, which going back with Peter Atkins and everything makes a lot of sense. It's really made talking and watching these things a little more enriching than you're just kind of watching it on.
Yeah. No, that's why I enjoy it so much. It's a lot of fun.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Of course. I love you.
Oh, God. Ugh. All right. You ruined Jesus. It. All right.
Okay. Bye.
Of experience, demons to some, angels to others.
It was a mistake. I didn't mean to help, but it was a mistake. You gotta help.
We can't. Not alone.
You solved the box. We came. Now you must come with us. Taste our treasures.
Now for the true crime of it all. The concept of a cube being used as a portal to hell has its basis in the urban legend of the Devil's Toy Box, which concerns a six-sided cube constructed of inward-facing mirrors. According to legend, individuals who enter the structure and then close it will undergo a surreal, disturbing phenomena that will simultaneously grant them a revelatory experience and permanently warp their minds. When Clive Barker was designing the Cenobites, he originally took inspiration from African sculptures. This is evident in Pinhead's appearance. Clive Barker used the Mangaka power figure. That sounds really weird. I'm sure I said it horrible, but that's M-A-N-G-A-A-K-A. Mangaka. That's how I'm saying it. That's how I think it's pronounced. This figure has pins and needles fashioned to the face and the body. He also drew from his experiences visiting S&M clubs from different parts of the world, including Amsterdam and New York, as well as like punk fashion. The Cenobites are thought to be a parody of the gay S&M scene, which was big in the 70s and 80s. Clive Barker spent time being a sex worker to supplement his income while he was writing. Most likely, the Cenobites are an archetype for the BDSM practices he took part in. The whole trope of it, it can be heaven or hell depending on who you ask. That's extremely true for these environments. Like, pain and pleasure are intertwined when you are into BDSM. And pain is like a prerequisite for the pleasure within these practices. In Hellraiser, Frank says, some things have to be endured. That's what makes the pleasure so sweet. I swear I'm not turning into a BDSM podcast, but I do want us to be sex positive here. There's nothing wrong with BDSM. If that's what you're into, that's what you're into. Like, no shame. I'm not going to say anything more. Although today the word Cenobite is often synonymous with Barker's creations, the word itself simply refers to priest or a religious leader. During development, Barker called the Cenobites hell priests and told the design team to make costumes for 4 or 5 super butchers. Barker's personal relationships and sex life are what leads us into the true crime portion of this podcast. As a gay man in the center of the AIDS epidemic, Barker has experienced discrimination, loss, and horrors of how our government ignored this health crisis. In response to these true horrors, he actually wrote a novel titled Sacrament that is unlike any of his other books. Neither horror nor fantasy. It is the story of Will Robjohns. I think I said that right. Of Will Robjohns, a famous wildlife photographer who has made his reputation chronicling the fates of endangered species, including his own. For even as Will rises to the pinnacle of his career, he is witnessing his own world, the close-knit San Francisco community that has nurtured and liberated him, ravaged by AIDS. This is the true crime of a homophobic culture that refused to acknowledge AIDS, leading to hundreds of thousands of deaths. Health officials first became aware of AIDS in the summer of 1981, but U.S. leaders remained largely silent and unresponsive to the health emergency. And it wasn't until September 1985, 4 years after the crisis began, that President Ronald Reagan first publicly mentioned AIDS. That is way too late. Way too late. By then, so many people had already been affected, and he just wanted to continue ignoring it. Scientists had identified the cause of AIDS, HIV, and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, identified all of the major transmission routes. But that was a long road, and they did not have help when they were trying to figure out what the hell was going on with the people affected with AIDS, which was largely gay men. It wasn't just gay men that were affected with AIDS. It was all kinds of people. At first, people suffering from this disease were treated like lepers. They were left to die alone and afraid. In the first few years, when little was known about the disease, about how the disease was transmitted, people were afraid to just touch someone who had AIDS. It was very sad. They were not treated humanely. They died a very lonely death. We could have done so much more for these people. And because of the population it was affecting, there was a lot of hate being thrown around, people saying disgusting things like, this is God punishing sinners and things like that, trying to correlate it with some kind of like plague that's being sent to the gay population, which is completely fucked up and untrue, because plagues affect everyone. Disease affects
everyone. It's everywhere. It always pops up. We're always going to have new diseases. And we need research. We need healthcare services for everyone. We need humane treatment. And get your kids fucking vaccinated, please. Because stop bringing shit back. Just side note. It didn't take long for fear of the gay plague to spread quickly. That's what they called it, not me. I'm not calling it that. That's what they did. They're assholes. Beyond the mortal danger from the disease, they also dealt with potentially being outed as homosexual if they had AIDS or an illness resembling it. AIDS was not just affecting gay men, although the disease was disproportionately affecting them. It affected anyone. It didn't discriminate. The kind of squeamishness around covering and discussing AIDS was evident during press conferences and among government officials at the time. During an October 1982 White House press briefing, conservative journalist Lester Kinslaving questioned Larry Speaks, President Reagan's press secretary, about the president's reaction to AIDS, which was then affecting some 600 people. When Kinslaving mentioned the disease was known as the gay plague, the press erupted in laughter. Disgusting. Absolutely disgusting. The fact that they would call something the gay plague and then, like, everyone's laughing at gay men dying. It's unconscionable. And it's unforgivable. And those people are probably still in the government. FYI, they're still around. It hasn't been that fucking long. The Center of Disease and Control was frustrated with the inadequate funding that led to little progress in finding a cure or prevention for AIDS. This restricted their work and was directly correlated with the increase in cases and casualties of this disease in the American population. CDC staffers wrote in a memo to Dr. Walter Dowdle, assistant director of the CDC at the time, "In addition, the time wasted pursuing money from Washington has cast an air of despair over AIDS workers throughout the country." On September 17th, 1985, President Ronald Reagan finally mentioned AIDS publicly. When responding to a reporter's question, he called it a top priority 5 years later. 4 years later. Yeah. And defended his administration's response and research funding. On October 2nd, Congress allocated nearly $190 million for AIDS research. That was $70 million more than the administrator's request, but a little too late. This came following Reagan's close personal friend, actor Rock Hudson, dying from the AIDS virus and thus dragging the disease into the public's eye. Under pressure, Reagan appointed a commission to investigate the epidemic, and towards the end of 1987, the country began taking steps to raise AIDS awareness by sponsoring AIDS Awareness Month, launching the American Response to AIDS advertising campaign, and mailing the Surgeon General's findings to every American household. By then, about 47,000 people had been infected with HIV in the United States. One of those people was Clive Barker. Clive Barker has HIV and lives with it. So this affected him very much on a personal note, and I'm sure was influenced in his making of Hellraiser. And then, you know, he made the other book, The Sacrament. He wrote that book, and I have not read it yet. But I want to read it. I think that it's a really important piece of history. All right, let's end on a high note. If you want to rewatch Hellraiser, or maybe you're watching it for the first time, you can find it on Amazon Prime, AMC Plus, YouTube TV, and Sling TV. You can watch it for free on Tubi and Pluto TV as well. Our villainous vixen, Claire Higgins, hates horror movies it's reported that when she saw this movie for the first time at the premiere, she had to leave after 10 minutes because it freaked her out so much. She has never seen the whole movie. The budget of this movie was $1 million. It earned about $20 million. It was the directing debut of Clive Barker, who had only two short films before this movie. He's also known for Candyman, Nightbreed, Books of Blood, and The Midnight Meat Train. I haven't seen The Midnight Meat Train, but that sounds like it's a fun name. It's on my list. Our Scream Queen, Ashley Lawrence, who plays Christy Cotton, is also in the second installment of the Hellraiser franchise. It's Hellbound, Hellraiser 2, Lost in the Labyrinth. She continues to work in the horror genre, but mainly for like TV series. She appears in like Tales from the Crypt is one of the things that she appears in recently. She was even in a Slipknot music video for the song Snuff. If you would like to collaborate on something, I would love the opportunity to connect with more people in the horror scene. I'm also thinking about making mini episodes. I'm taking suggestions on horror movies that would fit my theme of the month. If there's a movie you would suggest that fits the theme of Be Careful What You Wish For, you can email me at screamqueenpodcaster@gmail.com. I'm going to call these horror highlights, and it's just a way for everyone to kind of add to their index of horror fandom and categorize movies in certain ways. If you're in the Orlando area, I have a horror event each month at Conduit. The movies I cover each month at my events will also be what I cover on this podcast. So if you plan on attending any of my events, this is a good place to get a leg up on everyone else for the trivia portion of the night. My next horror event is Monday, January 20th. The movies I will be covering at the event are Wishmaster, Reanimator, and Hellraiser. I changed the movies around because having these three, it's just like too good to not have them put together. It's not just a trivia night. It really is just like an opportunity for community within the horror sphere. I release episodes every Thursday. Please be patient with me as I'm learning all this stuff as I go. I'm also trying to like work on my voice acting. One day I might sound like a singer of a metal band, and then the next like a possessed child. I don't know. We'll see what I can do. I'm going to have fun with it and not be afraid to try new things. Thank you for listening, and be careful what you wish for. Until next time, goodbye. Hee hee hee.